Hi, Women of Strength. Before we jump into today's episode, I just wanted to share something that's really close to my heart. If you're planning a VBAC or even just starting to think about one, you don't have to piece everything together on your own. You don't have to find every blog or hunt down a specific podcast episode. The VBAC Link Parent Prep Course was created by our founders, Julie and Megan, who are doulas and VBAC moms themselves. I actually took it when I was preparing for my own VBAC, long before I was a host of the podcast, just as a mom who needed clarity, confidence, and evidence-based information. So I can say, from a personal standpoint, that I know you'll love it. We also have a VBAC birth plan guidebook with a drag and drop template, and that's the exact template I used for my own VBAC birth. It made communicating with my care team so much more smooth. So if you're looking for practical, supportive VBAC prep from people who truly get it, you can find both the course and the guidebook at thevbaclink.com. All right, let's get into today's episode. Women of Strength, welcome back to the VBAC Link. I am your co-host, Lily. I'm joined today by Paige. And in just a few minutes by another Paige. Hi, Paige.
Hey, Lil.
I am so excited about today because someone very dear to me is coming on the podcast, my very own VBAC supportive provider, certified nurse midwife Paige. She is incredible, and we are having an in-depth conversation about continuous fetal monitoring today, and it is one that you don't want to miss. So turn up your EarPods, my friends, and
absolutely. And I told Paige, the midwife, at the end of our recording that this has been an episode I've been wanting to have for years, but we've been waiting for the right provider, and she is the right provider to have this conversation with because she holds it gently, she holds the nuance, and we trust her so deeply. We just do with our lived experience. We have a supportive provider list that is a compilation of providers that you have lived with and worked with, but we haven't seen them ourselves. So we have Paige here today who we have seen in action. We trust her so deeply. And this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart for Cesarean Awareness Month as a common reason for why C-sections happen, because it is the reason why three of my C-sections happened. For my first, it was late D-cells on PIT with a 35-week induction due to premature rupture of membranes. And then with my second, I had a crash cesarean under anesthesia for a prolonged D-cell shortly after an epidural. And then with my third, I had an emergent, right? We don't really know how to classify emergent, that all the time. Yeah. Due to some late D-cells with a lot of conversations. And it was a very thoughtful and very difficult decision to make, because I wanted my VBAC. I wanted that VBAC more than anything, but not more than I didn't want another crash cesarean. And my provider knew that. So it's so nuanced. I feel for you. I'm with you for the moms who have had to make that decision. It's not something that people really understand on the outside where they're like, oh, wow, like you made that decision for your baby. Your doctor saved your baby. You made the right call, because sometimes we wrestle with that. Like, did I make the right call when baby came out fine? That's the other thing too we talk about, because two of my babies came out fine. So it's very nuanced. We talk about all the things. That's so comprehensive. I was firing questions. Lily was as well. And Paige was just gracefully answering them all in with such patience.
Yeah, truly. She is just, I say this in the episode with tears in my eyes, but she's just someone I trust so implicitly. I trusted her with my birth. I wish that everyone could have a provider that they have this deep level of trust with. I jokingly call Paige my soulmate. She's my soulmate midwife. She really is. And if she ever moves out of Colorado, I'm going with her. I tell her that all the time, that if I had another baby and she lived out of state, I would fly there at 37 weeks pregnant. I would stay there until I had a baby, because she means so much to me, and the care that she provides. And I see this as a doula now, and the care that she provides to my clients, and it's unmatched. And so, yeah, Paige, you're going to read a review of the week and then we'll get into it. So Women of Strength, buckle up.
All right. This review today is from Apple Podcasts. Please leave us more Apple Podcast reviews, because we are lacking in them. But this one is from Lexi KG. We're not lacking in them. It's just current ones. We want some more current ones. We want to hear from you. And this review is titled, "Highly recommend to everyone I talk to. After having a C-section in November 2022, I had a successfully induced VBAC in August 2023, and all the information I learned from this podcast came into play. Thank you for all your effort in putting together evidence, experts, and encouraging stories. Just short and sweet. But this is why we do it, because we want to have you go into your birth empowered. We don't want you to have to question these conversations that you have or these options that you're presented with that are presented as the only option. Because in the back of your mind, you're like, I listened to the VBAC link. I know that I have more options. I know some questions I can ask. So thank you for this review, Lexi. And we will take a break for our intro and then get back with Paige.
Yay! Hi, I'm Lily.
And I'm Paige. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast.
We're moms and doulas who know firsthand that birth after cesarean isn't always straightforward. I'm a miscarriage and ectopic mom who went on to have a hospital water birth VBAC.
And I've had two CBACs and a planned maternal assisted cesarean.
Our experiences may be different, but our mission is the same: to make birth after cesarean better.
On this podcast, you'll hear powerful stories of VBACs, repeat cesareans, and CBACs from women around the world.
We'll also bring in expert insight, practical tools, and encouragement to help you feel informed and supported as you plan your next birth.
Whether you're preparing for a VBAC, choosing a repeat cesarean, or simply exploring your options, this space is for you.
Because every story matters, and we're here to remind you that you've got options, you've got support, and you're never alone.
The VBAC link is storytelling by nature. The stories on this podcast do not represent a universally best or safest option for everyone.
This podcast is intended to encourage and inform. It does not replace individualized advice from a qualified medical provider. All right, women of strength, welcome back to the VBAC link. I am sandwiched between two pages, which is so fun. I am so excited to welcome back my certified nurse midwife, Paige, who is joining us today to talk all about continuous fetal monitoring and what our options look like in labor. I'm going to read a little bit about Paige, and then we will get started and try not to confuse you by how many times we say Paige, because I'm also with co-host Paige, so it'll be a good day. All right. Well, about Paige, midwife. Paige was born and raised in the East Coast of Florida, where she earned her undergraduate degree in nursing at the University of Central Florida. She originally planned on becoming a pediatric nurse, but she fell in love with labor and delivery during her schooling. She worked as a labor and delivery nurse and childbirth educator at a small community hospital in Florida for 4.5 years, where she was able to provide intimate care to the diverse community during their pregnancy, birth, and postpartum periods. She decided to further her education to form deeper connections with women throughout their life. She graduated from Frontier Nursing University in 2022 with a Master of Science in Nursing, Certified Nurse, Midwifery. She was able to complete clinicals at both hospital and birth centers, which has helped shape her work philosophy. And then I'm going to just end your bio with this quote, because I love you. Birth is a natural process that occasionally needs medical intervention, not a medical intervention that occasionally occurs naturally. All right, women of strength, buckle up, because the last time we had Paige on, which was back in 2024 when I was pregnant with my own VBAC baby, there were so many quotes that I, to this day, quote. I post them sometimes on our Instagram page. So thank you for being here. We're so excited. There's been so much in the news lately about continuous fetal monitoring and how it leads to unnecessary cesareans. And I'm curious to know, like, the history of continuous fetal monitoring, what that looks like, and kind of how we got to where we are, if you have any background that you want to share.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Hi, everybody. So continuous fetal monitoring was introduced roughly like 50 years ago. When it first came out, about 20% of people were using it. So it actually wasn't super common. The whole purpose of it, it had good intention. It was that, could we decrease cerebral palsy? Cerebral palsy is essentially brain damage. It can happen before birth, during birth, or right to like directly after birth. It's typically like oxygen was deprived in certain parts of the brain, and that can cause babies to have issues later in life. They actually have normal life expectancies. Like, once the brain damage is done, it's not like a continued condition. It's just something that can happen like before, during, or after birth initially. So the goal for continuous fetal monitoring, it made sense. If we could watch these babies throughout the entire labor process, we could find a time when they were in distress and we could get them out before it progressed to cerebral palsy. So the intentions were good. So they started introducing it and they ran multiple studies on it. In 2017, I believe, there was a huge systematic meta-analysis on it, which is like our best type of evidence. They looked at many, many studies. This is very, very well researched. And the research is interesting. They found that it did not decrease cerebral palsy. It did not decrease NICU admissions. It did not decrease low Apgar scores. It did not decrease stillbirth or like neonatal death, which is interesting. The only thing it did decrease was neonatal seizures by about 50%, which was significant. However, neonatal seizures in themselves don't predict like lifelong outcomes like cerebral palsy and things like that. So that was really the only good outcome that came from continuous fetal monitoring. And then on the bad side of that, we saw C-section rates jump drastically. Now 1 in 3 women are going to have a C-section in the United States, which is quite a few compared to previous data where we were not doing nearly that many C-sections. And to do that many more C-sections, but to not have decreased rates in any of these bad things we're trying to prevent, it makes you wonder. We also had an increase in operative vaginal births, which is with vacuums, forceps, episiotomies, things like that. So increase in two, like, not as good outcomes in birth as people see it, but we didn't improve neonatal outcomes, which is the interesting part. So yeah, that's kind of the history of it. And you would think that these governing bodies for obstetrics would have looked at the evidence and said, hey, we're not supportive of this because it doesn't show that it's improving anything. Even the United States Prevention Task Force, which sets like standard, they give grades to different evidence, like A, B, C, D. A is the best evidence, you know, C is okay, and D is the worst. It actually gave continuous fetal monitoring a D. So it got a D grade, which is the worst grade you could get for how well evidence-based something is. And we still see majority, I mean, over 80% of women are using continuous fetal monitoring in labor. I think in certain situations, it's absolutely warranted. If we're inducing, which we do have higher rates of induction now, if there's a high risk scenario, you need to make sure that what you're doing and giving to the mom and the baby isn't causing harm. That's kind of how we make sure that we're not giving too much Pitocin, we're not overdoing it with meds, you know, or are we doing positions that are helping baby's heart rate out? So I think it can be useful in a lot of scenarios, but I also think it's completely overused. And a majority of low risk women would benefit from being on intermittent auscultation, which has been shown to have overall, like, no, you know, I mean, the same rates of continuous monitoring with those like cerebral palsy, low Apgars, all those things are the same, but we have decreased C-section and operative vaginal births.
Hmm. So if we take it to the VBAC conversation, are there improved rates of identifying uterine rupture with continuous fetal monitoring? Is there a sweet spot for what makes VBAC this like special, oh, well, our policy is VBAC across the board has to be on continuous monitors.
Yeah. And when you look at the studies for continuous fetal monitoring, they did not find any single fetal heart rate pattern that could indicate fetal distress. So when you think about uterine rupture, if the baby is in distress, there's no single pattern that will identify that distress. It's kind of the conversation, are VBACs or TOLACs, are they high risk or low risk? It's crazy because a lot of them are labeled very high risk because of the risk of uterine rupture, but that's a less than 1% chance of happening. So if that was the case, shoulder dystocia has about a 1% chance of happening. We could say everybody is high risk. If everybody has this chance of 1% of things happening, that's just really weird way to word it. But for whatever reason, we've decided like TOLACs are the super high risk population. And so many hospitals across the board are like, you have to have fetal monitoring, assuming that it will catch a uterine rupture before a mom notices it. I've never really agreed with it. I think if you're being induced or have an epidural, absolutely. But I've seen it. It's so funny. Like anybody who's been doing birth work for a while will know that like these fetal heart rate tracings really aren't good at predicting things. I've seen the best tracings in the world and the baby came out and didn't want to participate in life. And then I've seen like the worst tracings in the world. We rushed to the OR, the baby has 8-9 Apgars, or the baby comes out quickly, vaginal birth in 8-9 Apgars. And you're like, huh, like that didn't make sense. None of that. And that kind of is what the evidence showed, is that we couldn't predict it. So when you think of like a uterine rupture happening in a VBAC, that's a huge thing. Like not only is baby and you losing blood, but like your organ has ripped open. So I prefer for VBACs to be unmedicated personally, because I think if your organ, if your uterus is ripping open, you will be the first to tell me, and your baby's not even going to know it before you know it. So to me, like fetal monitoring isn't really a benefit in a VBAC continuously, unless you have an epidural or you're being induced or there's some other layer of situation there, preeclamptic, there's a known fetal anomaly, just some other level of risk there. But like natural spontaneous labor, and she has a history of 1 C-section, it's been over 18 months, like very low risk situation in my eyes. And realistically, if she's unmedicated and that uterus starts to rip open, that she's going to tell you, like, we are going to know that that is happening. where I've seen it on the flip side before. When I was a nurse once, there was a mom who had an epidural. She was a Tolac. She was somewhere around like 7 or 8 centimeters. And she started saying there was a really, really weird pain. Like, I felt different. It wasn't contractions. It wasn't pressure. And it was right near her scar. And she's like, this feels different. This feels different. Like, this isn't hurting. The epidural's not touching this. And the nurse was like, just push your button. No, no, no. You're just getting closer. You're getting closer. And nobody believed her because the baby looked really good on the monitor. They're like, surely you're not rupturing. Your baby looks fabulous. Everything is fine. And then like 10 minutes passes and the baby starts to show signs of stress. And it was like, fine, fine, fine. They rush her back. She had ruptured. She probably had been rupturing 10 minutes ago when she said she was feeling something very strange. But because the fetal monitoring tracing was good, no one believed her. So,
wow. I feel like I've always thought that it was coexisting with not great readings. Like, I think this is the first time I've heard a uterine rupture happening with good readings.
Yeah, for so like 10 minutes. That
can happen is really eye-opening.
Wow. Yeah. And it's like, we'll never know, like, when did she truly rupture? But if you look back when she complained of the pain, it's like, okay, right there. That's probably when it started. And it probably wasn't big enough quite yet. And baby was compensating and compensated as long as they could. And once baby could no longer compensate her, it got big enough and there was enough blood loss, they both tanked. So it's like, man, if she had been unmedicated or we hadn't been paying attention to the monitor and instead listening to the mom who was concerned about something, we probably could have gotten in a little bit quicker. Ultimately, the mom and the baby did great. However, like, what a stressful situation that could have been prevented and avoided sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how could you confirm? I mean, I guess that still seems a little tricky.
100%.
If a mom... So what are some signs? Like you said, pain in the scar, but women who are now scared, they're like, oh, well, now if the monitor's not even picking up, then how did I know it's going to happen? So what are some things that you can say to like comfort our community about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think like go with your gut more than anything. Anytime I've seen a uterine rupture, I feel like the mom knew. And maybe it was a hindsight situation. She was like, there was a weirder sensation there and I should have said something. But I've also seen it where, like, I have seen the baby tank and we were like, it must be uterine rupture. And we went back and sure enough, it was. So it's like one of those things, like, it can't be truly predictive. And if you're in a lower situation where you're in spontaneous labor, it is still very unlikely to happen. However, if you're in a more high-risk situation where you're being induced, like, it's a known really large baby, you have preeclampsia, like, something, there's another level there and you're on some kind of medication that could increase your risk of uterine rupture, like Pitocin. I would highly recommend having the continuous monitoring because if you're saying something and the monitor is showing something, then those two things are enough to like, let's get back and do something.
Mm. Okay, cool.
So as we're thinking about like spontaneous labor, so many women ask us, well, I'm being told by my provider that as soon as I'm in labor, I have to like run to the hospital and I have to get on monitors right away. Mm-hmm. And even ACOG, I mean, in their guidelines, they recommend continuous monitoring for the duration of a VBAC labor. So how do we, I mean, I know how you approached my own labor. I mean, I labored at home for days. but how do you advise your VBAC clients? Like, when is that sweet spot for getting to the hospital so we avoid some of that cascade of intervention, but also doing so safely?
Yeah. So if you're at home and you're not ready to go to the hospital, I would recommend monitoring baby's fetal movements. Your baby's fetal movements are a great indicator that baby is healthy and happy. We use that all throughout pregnancy. And it's really the only thing we have throughout pregnancy. Otherwise, we'd be seeing people every single day. So if you're at home and your contraction has a good normal pattern, they don't feel overly intense. You're not feeling extra pain or any weird sensations. There's no vaginal bleeding and baby's moving. To me, that's a healthy, happy labor. And why intervene? You know, if you're like, you know, baby's not really moving very much, I'm not feeling that very frequently, or there's just like weird pain and the contractions feel really close together, really, really long, then that would be an indicator. Like, I would go in and make sure everything's okay, kind of thing. And once you're there, I think like introducing that, like, if you're really are low risk and your provider's really persistent about continuous fetal monitoring and you really want intermittent auscultation, I think it's worth having a conversation and being like, so I read the evidence and the evidence shows that there is not a decreased risk of cerebral palsy, low Apgar scores, neonatal death or anything like that. How do you feel about doing intermittent auscultation? And if there's ever any sign for concern, I'd be happy to switch over. And I think a lot of times when like people are presented with the evidence and they're like, oh, why do we do this? Then it kind of makes them stop and think. And then a lot of times they're willing to meet somewhere in the middle. I know for a lot of our clients, we do a 20-minute tracing. And if in 20 minutes the baby looks perfect, then you can switch over to intermittent auscultation. I think a lot of policies around continuous fetal monitoring and around VBACs. It comes from like a litigation standpoint, which is really sad. I think so many providers and so many hospitals have fear of being sued and fear of if they didn't do every single thing and something happens that they're going to be sued. But if instead, I think if you have these like open conversations about this is what the evidence says, this is what it supports, this is what I feel comfortable with, this is what you feel comfortable with, and just meeting somewhere in the middle, then I think it makes everybody happy. I always talk about in appointments that informed consent is one thing and you should be informed anytime you're consenting to something, but informed declination is also equally as important. So if you've been informed and you're like, I understand your concern around not having continuous fetal monitoring if something happens to the baby, and that's why you want it. However, I am planning on going on medicated. I will let you know if I feel any weird sensations, if I have excessive bleeding, or if I feel like baby's not moving, and we will switch me to continuous. It's like, that's informed declination. You're declining it, but you're saying, hey, I'm informed of the risk. Like, you can put that in my chart.
Hmm. Do you have any advice for like us as birth workers? I was at a VBAC recently and I got a lot of pushback from midwife, from nurses on it. She has to be on the monitors. My client hated the monitors. She felt like they were making her contractions worse. And she eventually agreed to, we compromised on me holding the monitors on her.
Oh my gosh.
Because the belly band was awful, but they would not let her be off of monitors. And I wanted to scream a little bit because I was like, I have had a baby in a hospital in the system on continuous monitors. Like, I know that it's possible, but it was just a lot of pushback of it. It's policy. Yeah. Any advice for how we can advocate for our clients either as doulas or is there a point that we say, like, is there something they can sign? Like, what does that look like as an advocate to really helping our clients have that right to informed declination?
Yeah. You guys have it so hard because you're like trying to walk this middle road of, you know what I mean, supporting the client, but also being respectful and keeping good relationships with the providers. And it's so hard when you're like fighting an uphill battle. And it's like, where do we draw the line where I don't want to be like overstepping, but I also want to advocate for my client and what they want. I agree. I think saying like, hey, like she's going to state this out loud that she knows this and this is the concerns you have around this. And she'd like you to document in her chart that she is declining it with full informed information. And then just saying that out loud a lot of times is fine. I know in my hospital system, they actually have like, they call it a patient refusal checklist, which I'm like, oh, we need to reword that. I hate the word refusal. It's declination. Like nobody's refusing anything. They're declining. And they go through and they'll check like declined IV, declined continuous monitoring, declined this, declined that. And they'll just check it. I think they developed it for our practice, but.
I was going to say, I think my checklist was probably full.
So I know they have like a little checklist and then they can say like, she's been educated and she's still refusing it. She's been educated and she's refusing it. So it's like a nice little checklist for them. A lot of larger hospital systems should have something like that, or they should have a sign or a form that says like against medical advice, and they would write in what you're going against medical advice for. And realistically, like it's not against medical advice because the evidence doesn't support it. However, it would be against hospital policy or against, you know, providers' recommendation, essentially.
Taking a quick break from our episode to share this important stat with you. Did you know a 2025 retrospective cohort study published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology found that doula care was associated with about a 15.6 increase in VBAC rates compared to those without doula support? Lily and I love doulas, and we are doulas. The VBAC Link was founded by doulas Julie Frankham and Megan Heaton, who created a comprehensive VBAC course for doulas. It's fully self-paced, completely virtual, and when you complete it, you're added to the VBAC Link doula directory. You'll also earn 8 ICEA continuing education hours and become a VBAC certified doula. And if you're a parent looking for a VBAC Link certified doula, you can find one at thevbaclink.com/findadoula. All right, let's get back to the episode.
Awesome. Can we back it up just like a little and simplify what is continuous fetal monitoring and like what are the different ways you can do that? And then what does intermittent auscultation actually look like? Because a lot of our moms are pretty much first-time moms. Like some of them just had a scheduled C-section, never labored before. So a lot of this is brand new.
That's good, Paige. Thanks for that.
Yeah, that is good. We should have started with that. Okay. So we'll start with intermittent auscultation because it's a little bit easier. So intermittent auscultation is using a Doppler, just like during appointments when they listen to baby's heartbeat. So it's this little transportable device. They are waterproof for the probe part. The machine part is not. And you pretty much put it on the belly and you listen to baby before, during, and after a contraction. Typically in early to active labor, you'll do this anywhere from every 15 up to like the furthest I've seen is every hour, depending how dilated or how, you know, what your contraction pattern is looking like. And then when you get closer to pushing and you are pushing, then it tends to be every 5 minutes before, during, and after the contraction. So it gets more and more frequent as you get closer and closer to birth, essentially. And that's intermittent auscultation. The pros of that are that you have no like wires, no monitors on you, freedom of movement. Cons to that would be that sometimes like your position, it can take the nurses a minute to find baby's heartbeat with that, especially when you're in like hands and knees or like a deep squat position or baby's really low. Sometimes it can take nurses a minute to find that heartbeat. So sometimes people get a little annoyed and they start to feel like overtouched or overstimulated when somebody's coming every 15 minutes and taking them out of their focus, or they're like, you know, they're in labor land, they're focused, and somebody's like, okay, I'm going to listen to baby. And sometimes they can just pull you out of that a little bit. But pro is like definitely able to move and everything. You don't have to worry about a monitor. There's nothing like continuously on your belly, and that freedom of movement a little bit. Then we switch it over to continuous fetal monitoring. There's different types of continuous fetal monitoring. The most common one would be it's two monitors. One goes on the top of your belly to monitor contractions, and the one's kind of towards the bottom, and that's measuring baby's heartbeat. Typically, they have wires that plug into a machine, and that's how they continuously watch baby's heartbeat and your contraction patterns. So they have those two together to kind of coordinate what is the heart rate doing during the contraction, before and after it, and throughout. The wire ones, the downside is that you don't have a lot of freedom of movement. You can only go as far as the wires can go. Something's continuously on your belly. They have belts, they have bands. So there's different ways to tie them to your belly, which can bother a lot of people and just kind of also feel overstimulating sometimes. There's also wireless monitors, which I'm seeing much more common in hospital systems now, which is great. So it's the exact same as the wired ones, just they're wireless and they're waterproof. So you can walk around the room, you can walk around the units, like telemetry. It's essentially, it gets the signal from wherever you are on the unit, which is great because then you don't have to worry about, you know what I mean? Nobody's taking you out of labor land. You're continuously being monitored. However, they might have to adjust it every so often. But it's nice that they're waterproof and everything. So the baby can be monitored the entire time without you being bothered, essentially. And downside to that.
What are the ones with the stickers called?
Yeah, that's called a Novi.
Those ones are different.
Yeah. The Novi, she's a little bit newer. I remember, gosh, probably like 7 or 8 years ago. It was there, my hospital in Florida was thinking about getting it, but it was a little pricey. It's cool. It doesn't have any band or anything. It just kind of sticks on, and it's got like different stickers on the outside of it that monitor the contractions and the heartbeat. I've heard sometimes they work really great, and when they're working great, they're working great. I've heard other times it's like impossible to keep baby on and it doesn't work well. So I think they're going to keep developing it, and hopefully it'll get somewhere, because the idea of just having a sticker on your belly that you can move around with is way better than having two monitors and a belt or like a band, essentially. So I think it's up and coming. I hear it's getting better, but I still hear it's very black or white. It doesn't seem to be a lot of gray. Like, it kind of worked. It was like, it either worked great for me or it didn't work at all. And they were constantly messing with it, which is a bummer. So those are the continuous. And the other form of continuous monitoring is internal fetal monitoring. So this is when your bag of water is broken. There's internal monitors. One is called a fetal scalp electrode, and it's actually a little like spiral piece of metal that actually screws into the baby's head. I know that sounds terrifying. It is very small. It just goes into the skin. It's not going into the actual skull, but it is able to pick up baby's heartbeat through that. And that the pro of that is you get no artifact. You know for certain that is baby's heartbeat. Like, there's nothing else. Downsides to that is that it's there's something in your vagina hanging out and it has to be plugged in. There are some wireless forms of it, but not quite as common in hospitals. And then there's also,
can women move when they have that?
They can. Pretty thin, but it's definitely a little annoying. There's going to be something between your legs coming out of your vagina, even if it is thin.
Okay. Because I was told to stay in bed, but I just wonder, like, when I had one.
Yeah.
But
and yeah, honestly,
I didn't even know if you could.
Yeah. I've had some, like, I mean, I wouldn't do this, but I've had it where some people, like, they couldn't keep the baby on the monitor. It might have been like maternal size, movement, baby's position. It could have been multiple things. And the provider was so sick of like the nurse not being able to get the heartbeat, they just put a fetal scalp electrode on, which I don't love the idea of, because I mean, there's also risk for infection of baby. Baby's going to have a little mark on their head. There's always a chance that you put it in the wrong spot. It's supposed to be on the hard part of the head. If they accidentally put it in like a suture line or a fontanelle, it can cause damage. So it's not like the ideal one. However, if you're in like a really, I don't know, high risk situation where you can't tell, is this baby's heartbeat that's really low or mom's, and you know, you're concerned, it is a really nice tool to be 100% certain, like, this is the baby's heartbeat. I've also heard, I've never seen it, but I've heard of it accidentally going, like, somebody screwing it into the mom's vagina and getting the mom's heartbeat. I know. So you, I mean, you know, there could be some user error there. The newer ones at my hospital, it used to be really easy to put in, but now you have to push so hard. And like, I've seen them like have to reapply them 2 or 3 or 4 times, which is, now we've had 2 or 3 or 4 marks on the baby's head. That seems like a fail.
And it takes a while for that little scab to heal. It does.
Yes,
and
it's, I know.
It's like kind of sad to see a little baby with a little scab. So can you tell us what like normal tracings look like for a mom who is watching their baby and then a doctor comes in or a midwife comes in to have a conversation saying, we're not liking these tracings, but the mom wants to feel a little more empowered on their own to be like, okay, that matches the information that I know.
Yeah, I wish I had like a picture or something. Essentially, the way they look at fetal heart rate when it's continuous is it's put into 3 categories is how they've decided. Category 1 is like perfect, this baby is fine. Category 2 is like, it's up for debate. It's not perfect, but it's also not like, it doesn't mean something really bad is happening. And then category 3 is, hey, we're very concerned about this baby. This is a pattern that typically goes with like really poor outcomes. Category 2 is the hardest because it's like that conversation of like, is this baby doing well or are we just in a weird place? So those are the hardest ones. And category 2 tracings are actually probably the most common one to get a C-section for. And a lot of those babies will not be acidotic. They'll be totally fine and have perfect Apgars. And it's like, man, I guess that tracing really didn't tell us what we thought it was telling us. Category 1 tracing, for all of them, the baseline fetal heart rate should be anywhere from 110 to 160. And that should be what it is at a baseline. So if you see a heart rate tracing across a line, if you like drew a line straight across a heart rate tracing, it should be about where it hits that the most. That would be your baseline. Anything under 110 is considered bradycardia, and that's actually considered category 3. Interestingly enough, I've seen babies with like a baseline of 100. A lot of times they'll be on magnesium, which slows the heart rate. Sometimes they'll just be like a really post-date kind of baby, like 42 weeks and beyond. And their heart rate's like 115, 110, and then it's like 100 for a while. And it's actually normal for them, which is crazy because if we were going off of category 3, we would say, oh, this baby should come out right now. So baseline 110 to 160, the next thing they look at is variability. So variability is like, for lack of medical terms, how squiggly the line looks. There's minimal, moderate, and marked. So minimal is going to be it's not going to be very squiggly. It's going to be like a really barely squiggly line. Sometimes it even almost appears flat. Whereas moderate variability is going to be like somewhere in the middle. It's like 6 to 25 beats per minute, which like, if I had a picture, I could show you what that looked like. It just basically means that fetal oxygen status is probably great. And then there's marked, and that's where it's like big squiggles, like almost too much kind of thing. So we like to see babies in the moderate category. Minimal and marked can be signs that maybe baby's not as well oxygenated as we think, but babies also intermittently go into the minimal sometimes when they're sleeping and they don't need a whole lot of oxygen. So it's not like this perfect indicator. Like I said before, they found that there was no indicator of fetal heart rate that always indicated that something was wrong with baby. They didn't find that. Like, they always mean there's fetal distress. It doesn't always mean that. So we've got the baseline, we've got the variability, and then the next thing is, are there decelerations? So this is where the heart rate drops. So there's different types of decelerations. We have early, variable, and late. Early decelerations are like, it's like if you had your contraction as like a little hill, it's like if you inverted it at the same time as the contraction. And that translates to head compression. So a lot of times as babies come down on the cervix, we see head compression. And that's actually okay. Early decelerations are considered category 1 because we expect that to happen when the baby is kind of vasovagaling downward. And that's okay. Then we have variable decelerations. Variable deceleration kind of look like a V, which helps to remember it. So it's like the heart rate drops really quickly, but it comes up really quickly, typically with the contraction. And that's a sign of cord compression. So basically, if the baby squeezes the cord in their hand, if they have a cord around their neck and it gets a little tighter every time they come down, that can be a sign that the cord's being compressed somewhere. Typically happens with the contraction too. Then we have late decelerations. Late decelerations happen after the contraction. So they look just like an early, but it basically starts when the contraction's at its peak and then it continues as the contraction ends. This can be a sign of placental insufficiency. Out of all of these decelerations, this one's the most concerning one. It's like, is our placenta functioning okay? Variable deceleration, sometimes it can be as simple as we need to get the baby off the cord. So changing position, getting some more fluid in there, all those kinds of things can help to relieve that cord compression a lot of times. Or it might just be as baby gets deeper into the pelvis, their cord's not sitting so much on their chest and it moves down here and we don't have that compression anymore. So that's deceleration. Then the last thing is acceleration. So accelerations are a sign of fetal well-being. So that's where the heart rate jumps up. There's 10 by 10, which is where they go up like 10 by 10. If I had like a thing, I could show you better. And 15 by 15 just means it goes up by like 15 heartbeats for at least 15 seconds. Both are good. And those are a sign of like a good, happy baby, essentially. So if you have accels, you know, okay, baby's happy. And if you have good variability and there's no decels, like that's a happy baby. And decels are very nuanced because each one means a different thing. And like, are we interpreting it correctly? And like, are they recurrent or did it just happen like one time and it never happened again? There's a lot of conversation that goes into continuous fetal monitoring and like, how is your baby doing?
Mm-hmm. Any tips for women of strength that are navigating those conversations? Like how to know when it is like a, we gotta go now versus like, do I have a beat to take a minute and to understand asking for second opinions on interpretation, all of those things. Like how do we navigate those conversations when a provider's coming in saying like, your baby's not doing well, it's time to have a C-section. How do we, I mean, I know there's nuance, but what does that look like? Any tips there?
Yeah, I would ask to look at the tracing with the provider. I think sometimes like if I can show people, I'm like, hey, here, this is like, do you see this? And then I'll like pull up like an earlier part of the trace. I'm like, see how good it looked here and look where we are now. And kind of comparing that. I mean, if it were most heart tracings, even if it's like bad, they should have already been mentioned. It's very rare for a trace to be beautiful and then all of a sudden horrible. So if it's something that's been happening over time, I feel like there should have already been conversations with the nurses or the provider, like, hey, I'm starting to get a little worried. You know, this is what I'm seeing and it's starting to become recurrent. We're going to try all these different things. And if it works, wonderful. If it doesn't, like we might need to start talking about other ways we're going to get this baby out to make sure they're okay. So I think it's just like asking to see it, because I think when you have the visual and then you see like a comparison of like what a baby looked like when it was fine, a lot of times it's like, oh, like that's, I do see the difference now. Like that is kind of concerning. It's very rare that it's like your baby is perfect and all of a sudden your baby is like at the bottom tanking. And if that happened, that's a scary situation. And there's probably not going to be a lot of time to like show you all the things they're worried about. But if it's something that's happening over time, even if it's, you know what I mean, if it's not urgent, I think a lot of times you can just look at it and kind of have that conversation. And I always tell people, I like to have this acronym, basically. I used to have two. I'll just say both because one might make more sense to somebody else. The first one is that babies have a backpack. And in this backpack, they have lots of pencils. We don't know how many pencils they start with. And sometimes every time the heart rate drops, they lose some pencils. When they get to no pencils, they're not going to be able to keep going. And I don't know how many pencils they started with. So I like remind people, I'm like, they might have 200 pencils in that backpack and we might be able to do this 200 times and your baby will be totally fine. They might have 10 pencils in that backpack. I really don't know what this baby's reserve is. The other metaphor, if people are like, that made no sense to me, which that one did not make a lot of sense to people, is it's like when you rent a car and you get in this car and you start your drive and the hubcaps fall off the wheel or the tires. And you're like, oh, well, that's not good. And then the check engine light comes on. You're like, ooh, are we going to make it across the country? And it's like, you might, who's to say? There might be nothing else that happens on this journey, or you might get halfway through and the car completely breaks down. And there might be other signs along the way. That's kind of how labor is. And sometimes the babies will show us a sign really early and we get really worked up about it. And then they might make it to the end and there may be no other issues. That check engine light was on at the beginning, but it never had any issue throughout the whole thing. Whereas we might get the check engine light and then an hour, something else falls apart and then something else starts breaking. And then I don't know if we'll make it kind of thing. And it's like, do we want to push it to the part where the car breaks down or like the baby tanks and can't have that reserve to come back up? So a lot of times I try to present it to people early on. I'm like, hey, like, you know, this car is already showing us signs that maybe we're not going to make it to the end. I'm not going to call it now because I will never say never. We just can't do it in medicine. However, I do want to bring it to your attention. Like I'm already keeping a close eye on this baby for this reason. And, you know, if I start to see things, we're just going to keep having these conversations. And if at any point you don't feel like it's worth the risk anymore, you tell me and we will tap out.
Meaning C-section.
That. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, wow. Okay. Woo, emotions.
Yeah. And everybody has.
Thank you.
Yeah. Everybody has different risk tolerance too. I think that's a huge thing. I've had moms where like they came in labor and all, their baby just like had this huge decel and it took a really long time to come back. And then it was like beautiful. And I was like, that was really weird. Let's like start talking about this. And then it did it again. And the mom was like, you know what? This is too much for me. I don't know how many more times this is going to happen, but I like am not comfortable with this. And I'm like, I want to do what you're comfortable with. Whereas of other moms who are like, hey, you know what? If you're saying baby looks good right now, let's just see how many more times it happens. And I'm just going to make a decision like as we go along kind of thing. And it's a hard path.
Oh, it's so validating because just for my third, so that's like almost exactly what happened to me. And I want to share this because we're often left with questions like, did I make the call too early? Like, was that really necessary? Was the provider just like trying to push me to a C-section? And we got that in our CVAC group just today. But I had come from a VBAC attempt that ended in a crash. And it was a prolonged decel at about like 60. And I don't know, I don't remember all the details behind it because I didn't really have a lot of conversations before of like, this is trending. And we can talk more about epidural and decels too and how that affects stuff. Oh. Anyway, so that was the nature of my second. And then with my third, I was like, I don't want to crash or a stat C-section. I don't want to be under anesthesia. Like, that's really important to me to be awake. And I communicated that with my midwives. And then the midwife came in and she did exactly what you're saying. And so that's so validating to me, just like some of the questions that I'd been having about my care. Just like, I appreciate that she did that. I appreciate that she was thoughtful and showed me the tracings and walked through it and exactly the check engine light conversation. I love that metaphor of like, we don't know. And like the pencils, we don't know how much reserve there is for your baby. But like, and I was unmedicated at the time. I didn't have, all those things. Yeah. But like, we just can't control it. And sometimes we make that call and it's a good call to make. You can choose to keep going, and that's a good call if you feel right about that. But if you choose not to, like, that's a very valid reason to choose it. So 100%.
Yeah. I wish more people were just like honest with themselves in those moments, because I think a lot of times people are like, well, what would you do? And I'm like, this is not for me to decide right now. Like, this is your decision. I want to do what feels right by you. And I feel like so many moms who like have that C-section they weren't planning, they feel empowered by it if they got to make the call of when and how it happened. I've had so many moms who were like, you know, after that second big decel, they were like, I know you're telling me baby's okay right now, but I am so uncomfortable. I am so scared. And it's going to make me feel so much better to go back to the OR planned right now than if we have to run in an hour or two. And it's so hard because I can't predict the future. I don't know what's going to happen. And I'd rather that mom get to go in there and play her Jonas Brothers songs that make her feel happy, you know what I mean? Than us running back and she's asleep and nobody knows what's happening for a couple of minutes until somebody gets to bring the baby to dad. So like, it is important to make those empowered decisions and just like go with your gut. I feel like so many moms tell me, they're like, my gut told me to do this and I'm so happy I did it, which is, you know, usually you hear like, oh, I just had a C-section. I had no say in the matter. But a lot of people, when they get to make that decision for themselves because of something that felt right in their heart and their gut, like they're going to feel good about that decision.
Yeah. And I think this is why Women of Strength, that we tell you, and we will, Paige and I will say until we're blue in the face, like, you have to find the right provider. And the right provider isn't the provider that is going to guarantee that you have a VBAC. The right provider is the provider that's doing exactly these conversations and that's helping you evaluate what your risk tolerance is and helping you have information to make decisions for yourself and for your care. I was at a VBAC recently and a different VBAC than the last VBAC I talked about, I looked at the doctor with like tears in my eyes. And I was like, thank you for how patient you're being. Cause my client baby was getting cord compression and was not doing well. And my client was pushing and she'd be on one side pushing and she'd get through one push and baby would tank and they'd flip her. And that was her entire pushing stage, was back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I had never worked with this doctor before. And I looked at her and I was just like, thank you. And she was like, this is how it should be. Like, we should be able to be patient. Like, this is how it should be. We're getting her to a place where baby recovers and that's all I care about. And we're going to do this. So it doesn't have to be a midwife. Although I wish like literally everyone and their mother could have my sweet Paige as their midwife, but it just has to be and should be a provider that you feel respected and can have conversations with, because I think that's really what we're boiling down here, right? Is like, there's a lack of evidence and there's a whole lot of nuance.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, when they pick a VBAC supportive provider and not just tolerant, like, obviously your goal is a VBAC. I totally get that. But keep in mind that like just signing up for that with that provider does not guarantee you a VBAC. Like you're signing up for informed, like empowered care. And that should matter more than like the person who's going to get you the VBAC, because like a lot of times that empowered care will get you that VBAC, and 60-80% of women will have a successful VBAC. However, that 20%, if there was somebody who was supportive of VBAC and they felt really comfortable with that person, when that conversation comes up of, hey, this VBAC's no longer safe, that's going to be an empowered birth. Whereas if you're forced or coerced into something or fear-mongered, then it's not an empowered birth anymore. So I think remember that when you're picking your provider, you're not guaranteeing yourself any type of birth. You're guaranteeing yourself an empowered one.
Yeah. I say that all the time about you, and that like, during my labor, for women who have not listened to my story, it's episode 379 if you want to listen to all the deets. My labor was really long. I was in labor for 66 hours, and there were multiple moments that I like asked for an epidural, or we changed the plan. I asked for my water to be broken. I got a membrane sweep. I was on Pitocin. I had morphine and I had fentanyl. None of those things were things that were on my birth plan. And I had a provider in Paige that I could look in the eye. I'm going to feel teary. This is silly. But I could look in the eye and I knew, like deep in my soul, that our goals were aligned, that she was cheering for me, that she was telling me the truth, and that I was not being manipulated into a decision. And I will forever sing your praises because of just like that, you know, to be seen, to be known, to know my trauma. Y'all, Paige met me outside of the hospital to walk me up to labor and delivery because it was the same hospital I'd had my ectopic pregnancy at, and I did not want to go through the emergency room and feel that like trigger again. And she met me outside and was like, let's do this, and like walk up together. And that is what I hope for everyone in the whole world, because there's a reason I call her my soulmate midwife, okay?
Oh, you got me tearing up.
Aww.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So Paige talked about this a little bit, VBAC Paige. Let's talk about epidurals and how they can affect baby and even mom, like as we're kind of looking at the, like, okay, we're going to call it moment. How can getting an epidural affect what baby does on the monitors?
Yeah. So once you get an epidural, it's typically recommended that you do have continuous fetal monitoring. And I agree with it, because epidurals, even though it's not in your bloodstream, it still can have a profound effect on your labor and your baby's heartbeat. So the biggest side effect of epidurals is that it lowers your blood pressure. So a lot of times you'll get a liter bolus of fluids. They'll give you a bunch of fluid through the IV to kind of raise your blood pressure slightly. So when you have that drop, it's not this huge drop where your blood pressure tanks. Because if your blood pressure gets too low, then that means less blood flow to the placenta and the baby, which means baby can start to tank. So a lot of times if we don't get that blood pressure up a little bit, then it can be pretty profound and the babies can not tolerate it so well. Because if baby's not getting blood flow and oxygen and you're not getting blood flow and oxygen, like neither of you are tolerating this well. So that's why we like to have continuous monitoring with the epidurals, is because we want to make sure that's not happening. And a lot of times there's meds, there's positions, there's a lot of things you can do to counteract that side effect. And how do we know if it's working? The baby's heartbeat starts getting better. And we're like, okay, this position is clearly getting better placental flow. We gave a medication that raised the heartbeat, therefore raising the blood pressure. We gave more fluids. Like, these things are working. Look, baby was kind of not doing great. The placenta was showing us signs that it was not getting good blood flow. Now it's showing us that baby's totally fine. So I think it is nice to have it, just because that side effect is so profound. And you'll hear lots of stories of women who, you know, as soon as I got the epidural, my baby's heartbeat started not tolerating well and everything. And that's how I ended up in my C-section. And it was probably that side effect more than anything, is that the blood pressure got too low and the baby just wasn't getting enough oxygen through that placenta. It's also helpful.
Is there a way that like it could still have been an epidural causing that, even if you did things like, is it amnio infusion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So an amnio infusion.
With that, or like also flipping and those other things.
Yeah.
Still go back to the epidural.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be like your blood pressure was fine and baby was fine, and then hours later, your blood pressure could start to come down. Like, you can have a reaction to an epidural at any point because it's a continuous infusion. And sometimes like things that work don't make sense. I guess, like I said, the continuous fetal monitoring, like it's so nuanced. And like sometimes like things don't make sense. And the babies who give me gray hairs, I'm like, there was no reason this should have happened. And I've seen it happen in unmedicated labors too, where like all of a sudden the heart rate started dropping and I'm like, why is this happening? And we've done all the things. We did the amnio infusion. We did position changes. I tried everything that I could think of. And for whatever reason, this baby was just not looking like it was having a good time. So the epidural can cause that really at any point that you have it. It's typically most initially like right after insertion, because that's just when it's freshest in you. But I've even seen people who gave themselves a bolus dose, and the bolus dose is a safe dose. It's not supposed to overdose you. However, they were super sensitive to it, and that bolus dose tanked their blood pressure again. And so they had to get some meds and different things to bring that blood pressure back up so that baby is getting enough oxygen. And then it comes down to reserve too. Maybe the baby only had 3 D cells before it was like, can't do this anymore. Now labor is becoming too much. So it's like, we just will never know how much reserve every baby has, and they're all going to be so unique.
I love that conversation. And the conversation that like, it's okay to switch and to change your mind. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, again, I'm going to just talk about my birth because it's my midwife, so I get to. But I actually hated intermittent monitoring.
I was waiting for you to say that, Lily.
I remember looking at my sweet nurse, and I had the best nurses. Like, I adore them. And I remember looking at her being like, I know why you have to be here right now, but can you please go away? It was just so disruptive to me when Paige was talking about, like, when you're in a really deep squat, your girl delivered her baby on her tippy toes in the deepest squat of my life in the tub. And I just was in a position that my nurses were great. No one was asking me to get in a different position. No one was trying to, you know, make me do anything that was disruptive to me. But it was so disruptive to have someone, and then they would like catch baby, and then baby would move, and they had to like try again. And it was just, it was not the vibe. But I thought that that's what I wanted, because I thought that like, well, continuous monitors, like I've heard like the horror stories. I think I even asked Paige in my prenatal meetings though, like, well, how accurate are those continuous monitors? Like, how often do you have issues with those? Like, tell me about that. And I think that's a good question to ask. Like, ask your provider, like, what does that look like on those continuous monitors? How often do you find that they're reliable or not? We talked about that a little earlier. And when I got on Pitocin, the conversation shifted to like, hey, can we please put you on continuous monitors? Because you're getting a medication. It's different. It's changing the game. I'm still able to have a water birth, even on, I asked to be discontinued from the pit before I pushed, but
yes,
but I loved those continuous monitors.
Yeah.
They were great because people left me alone. Finally, I was like, great. I can just do my thing and no one's touching me anymore. So I actually really loved them. So I think it's okay to change your mind in labor too. And maybe you're like me and you thought that like, wow, this is the path that I'm supposed to go on because I've heard so many awful things about continuous monitoring. And it's okay to change your mind. It's okay.
You know? 100%. I'll never forget when we put you on it and you were like, oh, I think I like this better. And then you got completely dilated. And I remember asking you, I was like, do you want the monitors back off? Because you're not on Pitocin anymore. Like, let's just have this baby with nothing. And you're like, no, I prefer these actually. And it was such a switch. Yeah. And, you know, at the end of the day, it really didn't matter which one we had on Tilly, because her heart rate was beautiful during intermittent. It was beautiful during continuous. Like, she tolerated the whole thing. So she had great reserve in her tank and really never had any D cells. So, you know, like a baby like that, it wouldn't have made a difference either way in that situation. But it's, you know, if a baby we're catching early on and we're like, hey, we know this is like just 20 minutes of you being here, but look, we're already seeing some signs that maybe there's something going on. How do you feel about watching for a little bit longer? And a lot of people are like, oh, absolutely. Like, I see what you're talking about. I'd like to keep an eye on it. And then I've done it where like it went away. I don't know. She was on the market for like an hour after that. And I was like, oh, whatever we were worried about before, I have not seen it in an hour. If you want to go to intermittent, I'm happy to switch you to that at this time. And the people are like, oh, great. Okay. Yeah, let's switch it. I've also had it where we were doing intermittent and we heard something. We were like, hey, we're having trouble figuring out if this is a late, a variable, like, but the baby's heart rate is dipping. And if we can see it on the monitor, we can really tell like where this heart rate deceleration is coming from. Like, is it coming from a good place that the baby's coming down, or is it coming from like, we need to be aware of something going on? And I've never had a mom be like, absolutely not. Usually if you bring a concern up about the baby, they're going to be like, yeah, let's check it out. And sometimes we put them on the monitor and we're like, oh, look, no, we were wrong. Baby looks great. We'll take you back off. Or we're like, oh, I'm glad we did this. Do you see this? We're going to keep an eye on this kind of thing. And it could change something. I feel like if it could change something in your plan, it's worth doing the intervention or like worth doing the continuous fetal monitoring. But if it's not going to change anything, then like, let's not do it. I've been like written up before, to be honest, because I had a mom who was on intermittent and she was having some variable deceleration. She was 9 centimeters dilated. So she was almost there. The baby sounded beautiful between. They were little variables. They weren't very deep. So I knew there was probably a cord around the baby's neck. And as she got deeper, like, you know, there was going to be some cord compression. So we asked if we could put her on continuous just to get a better look at it. She agreed. We put her on for 20 minutes. We did see some variables. They weren't anything concerning. The variability looks good. Like everything else was reassuring. I just knew there was cord compression somewhere. The mom hated the monitor. She was like ripping them off. She's like, I can't do this. Like, we have to take me back on the Doppler. And I was like, that is completely fine. I was like, it's variables at the end of the day. I'm like, I would do absolutely nothing different because we're about to start pushing. And I know there's a cord. I'm anticipating it. And it's not going to change something for me in this moment. The baby just needs to come out. And sure enough, the baby came out with a cord around the neck. We switched back to intermittent auscultation for the duration of her labor. And it never changed. And we just always made sure we listened for a good, like, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds after the contraction to make sure it really was staying recovered. And it didn't like go down and stay down. And she had a great birth and everything was fine. The cord was around the neck. And it's like, oh, that's what I was anticipating. So sometimes even like, you know, decelerations wouldn't change anything in your plan of care. I'm certainly not going to put a tube through her vagina past the baby's head and give her fluid at 10 centimeters dilated. And I'm starting to see a crown. You know what I mean? That's not going to change something. Like it has to change something in my plan of care. And when I went on like the peer review committee for it, they were like, well, wouldn't have you done something different? Wouldn't have you made her do this and this? And I'm like, she was in a good position. Actually, when she started pushing and she squatted over the toilet, the variable decelerations went away for a while. So realistically, I wasn't going to change anything. And if she's like ripping it off, I can't force her to be on continuous fetal monitoring. She was agreeable to listen a little bit more frequently. I think we were doing it every like 3 minutes instead of every 5 minutes during pushing, just so we can make sure that it wasn't like staying down. You're going to recover beautifully. And like 9 times out of 10, that's what's going to happen with variable decelerations. Very rarely do variables actually, you know, cause like a true C-section because we're worried about distress. We just know there's cord compression somewhere.
So do you think, why do you think that most of these C-sections are happening, like these unnecessary ones that are due to these decels?
I think it's fear of litigation more than anything. And it's really sad that it has to be that way. But I think, you know, if we see even like a little bit of distress and we're like, we don't really know. Like I said, there's no fetal heart rate pattern that indicates true fetal distress. They could not find a common ground on that. There's nothing that will predict it. However, if we are using this in a way to predict fetal distress, of course, when we see things that don't look perfect, we're going to use it as an indicator. We're going to say, hey, we need a C-section. Like, this is going to save your baby. You need to do this right now. And moms aren't going to say no. And then we go to the OR, we do the emergency C-section, and the baby comes out perfect. And we're like, huh, maybe that baby wasn't in distress after all. Even some of the most like ominous patterns, when you look at the like huge meta-analysis, like there are some patterns that are that Category 3 where it's like, hey, baby is not doing well. Actually, quite a few of them weren't even acidotic. And an acidotic baby, it's like the pH of the cord would mean like, that can mean brain damage, that can mean low oxygen and all these different things. But a lot of them didn't even have acidosis. So it's just crazy. I mean, I feel like anybody who's been doing birth work long enough can have some like humility and be like, look, I've been doing this long enough to know that like, not all babies created equal. And I have babies who I swear actually gave me gray hairs and came out completely fine. But if you would have looked at their heart rate tracing, you would have been like, oh my gosh, like that's horrible. Like, did she have a C-section? I'm like, no, she had a vaginal birth. And guess what? Baby was fine. And on the flip side of that, I've had tracings where I'm like, wow, this baby just looks phenomenal. Good job, good job. And then the baby comes out and it's like, doesn't cry, no tone, like doesn't want to participate in life. And it's so interesting to see the two sides of that. And that makes it really hard for providers, like, or, you know, that makes you want to like call it as soon as you see any little thing because of that fear. And you don't want to make the wrong call. And it's so hard. And I wish more providers leaned on joint decision-making with their clients. Cause again, I think if there's like that aligned team sense and you're like, hey, I'm worried about X, Y, Z, that I want to show you this. And then like the client is instead like making an informed decision. It just looks so much better. But it's so hard when like a lot of providers have to practice in a state of like a place of fear that they don't want to get sued. They don't want to make the wrong call. It's a really hard bargain.
What would you say? Let's just pretend that you get to speak now to all of the really like cocky providers, the ones that have the arrogance of, you know, this is my way or the highway. Perhaps they wear cowboy boots into the operating room. and they have that level of this is my decision, this is my labor, this is how I manage my labors, that attitude when it comes to fetal monitoring, if you could speak like provider to provider, heart to heart, what would you say?
I would say we both have degrees. We know how to read evidence. We know how to look at the different values and levels of evidence. And I would encourage them to go read about fetal monitoring and the evidence behind it, because I feel like you can't be, you know, the most cocky, best provider in the world if you're not following the evidence. And I feel like some of the best providers like question the system, you know, and I think a lot of it, like a lot of them just tend to rely on hospital policy, but hospital policy has to be challenged time and time again if it's not up to date on like what is evidence-based. So yeah, I just feel like if you're a provider and you have this degree, I know you know how to read evidence. I know you know how to evaluate if it's like good evidence or not. Like, go and read it and kind of figure out, why is ACOG recommending that we use continuous fetal monitoring for all these people? And why is like people are able to have VBACs at home? They're not having continuous fetal monitoring there. So if you really have this low risk person, like a TOLAC in and of itself just is not a high risk situation. And I would just encourage them to read the evidence and really get behind what is that saying, because that should be influencing your practice more than how you've always done things.
Yeah. Can we also touch on, we look to ACOG as this like, ACOG says, and I even find myself doing that on stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I've been quoting ACOG's informed refusal statement a lot lately with some things that have come out in the news about, you know, forcing women into cesareans and all of those things. But when ACOG isn't following the evidence, like, I don't know. I don't even know that I have a question there. It's just frustrating, you know, because we look to it as this standard of care. And how do we encourage, you know, discussion about evidence, even when the governing body of obstetrics is saying it's fine, we're just going to continue to recommend it.
I know. And you know what's interesting? ACOG even has different levels of evidence, and a lot of their like recommendations are committee opinions. So it's like, hey, we don't have enough evidence to say if this is right or wrong, but our committee has the opinion that this is correct. And people take it as like hearsay. They're like, yep, that's it. They all agreed on it. They're the experts. But there's no evidence to support that. We're just going off of opinions. Like, it's so hard with something like continuous fetal monitoring. Because I think it was created with a good intention. Like, can we decrease cerebral palsy? Can we decrease low apgars? Can we decrease stillbirth and labor? Can we decrease NICU admission rates? But we've seen no decrease in any of those rates. And we've only had an increase in cesarean and operative vaginal delivery. I mean, is it correlation or causation? You know, I mean, to me, it's causation. And if it's correlated, there is a big correlation there. And that should like get people thinking about what is right and like how much are they acting on these tracings. And what they should be doing, I think, in hospitals is going back and looking at certain providers' C-section rates and looking at those tracings and having it reviewed and being like, could we have waited here a little bit longer? Like, was this really category two? You know, sometimes people just be like, oh, I just feel icky about this. And I think I just want to like cut this person because I just feel icky about this tracing. And it's like, but if everybody else thinks it looks good and it is categorically category one, maybe sometimes category two, that overall is a good tracing. And it's hard because you don't want to go against what like an experienced provider knows. Cause I also think there's a lot of wisdom that comes with like doing this for a long time. And even I have the humility to say, like, I haven't been doing this for 10 years. Like, I haven't been a midwife for that long. I've been in the birth world for a good bit, but I certainly am not like the most experienced out there. But I think like when you take the ego and humility out of it and you just take a step back, I think you have to really like look at your rates, like look at like why you did certain C-sections, like have other people look at it, go into peer review. Like, I think if people started taking their egos out of it and just were a little bit more humble, they could probably all learn something and we could decrease the C-section rate in America drastically. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
This is why I love you. Paige, VBAC link Paige, do you have anything final that you'd like to say in this conversation?
Maybe just like two more questions. Okay. Yeah. One of which I have heard the narrative that if you breathe enough, like if the woman is breathing adequately, she's sending enough oxygen to her placenta, which then can help a baby's heart if they are having D cells. What do you say to that?
I have never heard that before. I'm going to say probably not. However, I think if you're having like a panic breathing episode and you're not getting good oxygenation, like it can be really valuable to be like, hey, take a second, like take some deep breaths. Like even I find myself taking that, like, hey, take a couple deep breaths for you and baby. So like, I do think if like you're not breathing, you're like you're not getting enough oxygen. Yes. In that case, yes. But interestingly enough, when they talk about when fetal heart rates are down, there's different interventions you do, position changes, IV fluid bolus. And we actually used to give oxygen to moms. We used to give them like 100% oxygen in a mask. And we were like, breathe slowly to give baby more oxygen. Because if your oxygen goes up in your blood, it'll go up through the placenta. And they actually don't recommend doing that anymore. They recommend that as like the absolute last line of defense. Because what happens is we like over-oxygenate these babies. And when they come out, they're used to having like this insane amount of oxygen. And they actually don't cope so well. So,
okay. Well, I was one of those who was oxygenated. And then when my baby was having D cells in my third birth, I was like, okay, I need to breathe. And then there was some guilt carried where it was like, oh, I didn't breathe good enough, I guess.
No. Yeah. It's not that you didn't breathe good enough or anything like that. There's absolutely no way. I mean, realistically, if the placenta is not getting enough oxygen, your breathing could not be enough to like truly influence that deeply.
Thank you. And then the other one is, what would you say to women who are afraid of a stillbirth happening in the in-between of the intermittent, and that's why they're afraid of the intermittent monitoring?
Oh, gosh. We're talking about a less than 1% chance of stillbirth. If you are truly low risk, I mean, you have no complications, you're not being induced, you're in normal active labor, you've had reassurance that baby looks good, you're intermittently hearing that baby looks good, your risk of having a stillbirth spontaneously in labor is so low. I mean, so like less than 1%. So that means 99.9% of these babies will be born totally fine. So I don't want you to get hung up on the less than 1%, because there's a 99% chance, over 99% chance that this baby will be totally fine. And I think sometimes we focus so much on the 1% or less than 1%, we forget about like, oh, well, there's a 99.9% chance that everything will be fine. And, you know, I mean, checking in, like having little check-ins with your provider. Hey, does everything sound okay? I feel like so many moms ask me in those moments, they're like, okay, baby sounds good, right? I'm like, yes, baby sounds great. And like, you might need those check-ins, and that's okay to ask for those check-ins too, because sometimes we're just gathering our information. We forget to vocalize it to you. Like, hey, baby is safe. You are safe. This is okay right now. Especially when you're in labor land, you know what I mean? You're just elsewhere. So asking for those little check-ins to know that everything's okay. And yeah, just remind yourself, like, you have the majority of this going the right way. Like, don't focus on that less than 1%. Because I do believe like a little bit of manifestation, like don't get me wrong, I don't think you're going to like manifest your way out of that. However, if we only focus on the negative, on those things, like you're like mind over matter. And I don't want you to get so caught up in that, that you're so anxious about everything. That's going to make for a really anxious, unhappy labor and birth experience, I think.
Totally. Thank you.
Yeah.
So good. All right. Well, Midwife Paige, if women of strength are listening to this episode and they say, I want that lady to be my midwife, where can people find you? How can they connect with you?
You can find me at A Woman's Place in Fort Collins, Colorado. I have an Instagram. It's just like my personal Instagram, but feel free to follow me at Paige_Cassidy. And then at A Woman's Place, Fort Collins, I believe is our Instagram for our practice. So yeah.
I think.
Maybe.
I think so. I'll double check. Let's see.
And that might not be my at. I think I might have another underscore somewhere.
Yes. The clinic is A Woman's Place.
We're going to tag her in the show notes, guys. Don't worry. It's in the show notes.
Yeah, you have an underscore at the end of Cassidy, too. Paige.
Okay, I think there's something else there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on today. We appreciate you, and you are just the best.
Yes, thank you guys for having me. It's always a joy.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbacklink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbacklink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode and for being a part of our community. One of my favorite parts of the VBAC Link is the community itself. When I was pregnant and planning for a VBA 2C, the VBAC Link community group on Facebook truly became a virtual village for me. It's where I could see real VBAC stories, ask questions without judgment, and get encouragement from people who genuinely understood what I was preparing for. If you are planning a VBAC and want support as you get ready, head over to Facebook and search the VBAC Link community, because women of strength become even stronger together.